wet his brush and scrubbed on manfully. "Have you ever visited the pleasure houses of lice?" the dwarf inquired. "Might that be where whores go?" Tyrion could not seem to recall the Valyrian word for whore. In any case, it was too late. The boy tossed his brush back in his bucket and took his leave. "The wine has blurred my wits." He had learned to read High Valyrian at his maester's knee, though what they spoke in the Nine Free Cities, well, it was not so much a dialect as nine dialects on the way to becoming separate tongues. Tyrion had some bravosi and a smattering of Mirish. In Tyros he should be able to curse the gods, call a man a cheat, and order up an ale, thanks to a sellsword he had once known at the Rock. At least in Dorne they speak the common tongue, like Dornish food and Dornish law. Dornish speech was spiced with the flavours of the Rhoyn, but a man could comprehend it. "Dorne, yes, Dorne for me." He crawled into his bunk, clutching that thought like a child with a doll. Sleep had never come easily to Tyrion Lannister. Aboard that ship, it seldom came at all, though from time to time he managed to drink sufficient wine to pass out for a while. At least he did not dream. He had dreamt enough for one small life, and of such follies, love, justice, friendship, glory, as well dream of being tall. It was all beyond his reach, Tyrion knew now, but he did not know where whores go. "Wherever whores go," his father had said, his last words, and what words they were. The crossbow thrummed. Lord Tywin sat back down, and Tyrion Lannister found himself waddling through the darkness with Varys at his side. He must have clambered back down the shaft, 230 rungs, to where orange embers glowed in the mouth of an iron dragon. He remembered none of it, only the sound the crossbow made and the stink of his father's bowels opening. "Even in his dying, he found a way to shit on me." Varys had escorted him through the tunnels, but they never spoke until they emerged beside the Blackwater, where Tyrion had won a famous victory and lost a nose. That was when the dwarf turned to the eunuch and said, "I've killed my father," in the same tone a man might use to say, "I've stubbed my toe." The Master of Whisperers had been dressed as a begging brother, in a moth-eaten robe of brown rough-spun, with a cowl that shadowed his smooth, fat cheeks and bald, round head. "You should not have climbed that ladder," he said reproachfully. "Wherever oars go," Tyrion warned his father not to say that word. "If I had not loosed, he would have seen my threats were empty. He would have taken the crossbow for my hands, as once he took Tysha for my arms. He was rising when I killed him." "I kill she too," he confessed to Varys. "You knew what she was." "I did, but I never knew what he was." Varys tittered. "And now you do." "I should have killed the eunuch as well. A little more blood in his hands, what would it matter?" He could not say what had stayed his dagger, not gratitude. Varys had saved him from a headsman's sword, but only because Jaime had compelled him. "Jaime, no, better not to think of Jaime." He found a flesh skin of wine instead, and sucked at it as if it were a woman's breast. The sour red ran down his chin and soaked through his soiled tunic, the same one he had been wearing in his cell. The deck was swaying beneath his feet, and when he tried to rise, it lifted sideways and smashed him hard against a bulkhead. "A storm," he realized, "or else I'm even drunker than I knew." He retched the wine up and lay in it a while, wondering if the ship would sink. "Is this your vengeance, father? Has the Father above made you his hand? Such are the wages of the kinslayer," he said as the wind howled outside. It did not seem fair to drown the cabin boy and the captain and all the rest for something he had done. But when had the guards ever been fair? And round about then, the darkness gulped him down. When he stirred again, his head felt like to burst, and the ship was spinning round in dizzy circles, though the captain was insisting that they'd come to port. Tyrion told him to be quiet, and kicked feebly as a huge ball sailor tucked him under one arm and carried him squirming to the hold where an empty wine cask awaited him. It was a squat little cask, and a tight fit even for a dwarf. Tyrion pissed himself in his struggles, for all the good it did. He was crammed face first into the cask, with his knees pushed up against his ears. The stub of his nose itched horribly, but his arms were pinned so tightly that he could not reach to scratch it. "A palanquin fit for a man of my stature," he thought, as they hammered shut the lid. He could hear voices shouting as he was hoisted up. Every bounce cracked his head against the bottom of the cask. The whirl went round and round as the cask rolled downwards, then stopped with a crash that made him want to scream. Another cask slammed into his, and Tyrion bit his tongue. That was the longest journey he had ever taken, though it could not have lasted more than half an hour. He was lifted and lowered, rolled and stacked, upended and righted, and rolled again. Through the wooden staves he heard men shouting, and once a horse whickered nearby. His stunted legs began to cramp, and soon hurt so badly that he forgot the hammering in his head. It ended as it had begun, with another roll that left him dizzy and more jouncing. Outside, strange voices were speaking in a tongue he did not know. Someone started pounding on the top of the cask, and the lid cracked open suddenly. Light came flooding in, and cool air as well. Tyrion gasped greedily and tried to stand, but only managed to knock the cask over sideways and spill himself out onto a hard-packed earthen floor. Above him loomed a grotesque fat man with a forked yellow beard, holding a wooden mallet and an iron chisel. His bedrobe was large enough to serve as a tawny pavilion, but its loosely knotted belt had come undone, exposing a huge white belly and a pair of heavy breasts that sagged like sacks of suet covered with coarse yellow hair. He reminded Tyrion of a dead sea cow that had once washed up in the caverns under Casterly Rock. The fat man looked down and smiled. "A drunken dwarf," he said, in the common tongue of Westeros. "A rutting sea cow." Tyrion's mouth was full of blood. He spat it at the fat man's feet. They were in a long, dim cellar with barrel-vaulted ceilings, its stone walls spotted with nitre. Casks of wine and ale surrounded them. More than enough drink to see a thirsty dwarf safely through the night. Or through a life? "You are insolent, I like that, in a dwarf." When the fat man laughed, his flesh bounced so vigorously that Tyrion was afraid he might fall and crush him. "Are you hungry, my little friend? Weary? Thirsty?" Tyrion struggled to his knees. "And filthy?" The fat man sniffed. "A bath first, just so. Then food and a soft bed, yes. My servants shall see to it." His host put the mallet and chisel aside. "My house is yours. Any friend of my friend across the water is a friend of Illyrio Mopatis, yes. And any friend of Varys the Spider is someone I will trust just as far as I can throw him." The fat man made good on the promised bath, though. No sooner did Tyrion lower himself into the hot water and close his eyes than he was fast asleep. He woke naked on a goose-down feather bed so soft it felt as if he'd been swallowed by a cloud. His tongue was growing hair, and his throat was raw, but his cock was as hard as an iron bar. He rolled from the bed, found a chamber pot, and commenced to filling it with a groan of pleasure. The room was dim, but there were bars of yellow sunlight showing between the slats of the shutters. Tyrion shook the last drops off and waddled over patterned mirish carpets as soft as new spring grass. Awkwardly he climbed the window seat and flung shutters open to see where Varys and the guards had sent him. Beneath his window, six cherry trees stood sentinel around a marble pool, their slender branches bare and brown. A naked boy stood on the water, poised to duel with a bravo's blade in hand. He was lithe and handsome, no older than 16, with straight blonde hair that brushed his shoulders. So lifelike did he seem that it took the dwarf a long moment to realize he was made of painted marble, though his sword shimmered like true steel. Across the pool stood a brick wall, 12 feet high, with iron spikes along its top. Beyond that was the city, a sea of tiled rooftops crowded close around a bay. He saw square brick towers, a great red temple, a distant manse upon a hill. In the far distance, sunlight shimmered off deep water. Fishing boats were moving across the bay, their sails rippling in the wind, and he could see the masts of larger ships poking up along the shore. Surely one is bound for Dawn, or for Eastwatch by the sea? He had no means to pay for passage, though, nor was he made to pull an oar. I suppose I could sign on as a cabin boy, and earn my way by letting the crew bugger me up and down the narrow sea. He wondered where he was. Even the air smells different here. Strange spices scented the chilly autumn wind, and he could hear faint cries drifting over the wall from the streets beyond. It sounded something like Valerian, but he did not recognize more than one word in five. Not Bravos, he continued, nor Tyrosh. Those bare branches and the chill in the air argued against Lice and Mir and Valantis as well. When he heard the door opening behind him, Tyrion turned to confront his fat host. "This is Pentos, yes?"
"Just so. Where else?"
"Pentos? Well, it was not King's Landing. That much could be said for it. Where do whores go?" he heard himself ask.
"Whores are found in brothels here, as in Westeros. You will have no need of such, my little friend. Choose from amongst my serving women. No one will dare refuse you."
"Slaves?" the dwarf asked pointedly. The fat man stroked one of the prongs of his oiled yellow beard, a gesture Tyrion found remarkably obscene.
"Slavery is forbidden in Pentos by the terms of the treaty the Bravassi imposed on us 100 years ago. Still, they will not refuse you."
Illyrio gave a ponderous half-bow.
"But now my little friend must excuse me. I have the honour to be magister of this great city, and the prince has summoned us to session."
He smiled, showing a mouthful of crooked yellow teeth.
"Explore the manse and grounds as you like, but on no account stray beyond the walls. It is best that no man knows that you were here."
"Were? Have I gone somewhere?"
"Time enough to speak of that this evening. My little friend and I shall eat and drink and make great plans, yes?"
"Yes, my fat friend," Tyrion replied. "He thinks to use me for his profit." It was all profit with the merchant princes of the free cities.
"Spice, soldiers, and cheese lords,"
his lord father called them with contempt. Should a day ever dawn when Illyrio Mopatis saw more profit in a dead dwarf than a live one, Tyrion would find himself packed into another wine cask by dusk. "It would be well if I were gone before that day arrives." That it would arrive, he did not doubt. Cersei was not like to forget him, and even Jaime might be vexed to find a quarrel in father's belly. A light wind was riffling the waters of the pool below, all around the naked swordsman. It reminded him of how Tysha would riffle his hair during the false spring of their marriage, before he helped his father's guardsmen rape her. He had been thinking of those guardsmen during his flight, trying to recall how many there had been. You would think he might remember that, but no. A dozen, a score, 100, he could not say. They had all been grown men, tall and strong, though all men were tall to a dwarf of 13 years. Tysha knew their number. Each of them had given her a silver stag, so she would only need to count the coins. "A silver for each, and a gold for me." His father had insisted that he pay her too. A Lannister always pays his debts.
Wherever oars go,
he heard Lord Tywin say once more, and once more the bowstring thrummed. The Magister had invited him to explore the manse. He found clean clothes in a cedar chest, inlaid with lapis and mother-of-pearl. The clothes had been made for a small boy, he realized as he struggled into them. The fabrics were rich enough, if a little musty, but the cut was too long in the legs and too short in the arms, with a collar that would have turned his face as black as Joffrey's had he somehow contrived to get it fastened. Moths had been at them, too. At least they do not stink of vomit. Tyrion began his explorations with the kitchen, where two fat women and a potboy watched him warily as he helped himself to cheese, bread, and figs.
"Good morrow to you, fair ladies," he said with a bow. "Do you know where oars go?"
When they did not respond, he repeated the question in High Valyrian, though he had to say courtesan in place of whore. The younger, fatter cook gave him a shrug that time. He wondered what they would do if he took them by the hand and dragged them to his bedchamber.
"None will dare refuse you," Illyrio claimed.
But somehow Tyrion did not think he meant these two. The younger woman was old enough to be his mother, and the older was likely her mother. Both were near as fat as Illyrio, with teats that were larger than his head.
"I could smother myself in flesh."
There were worse ways to die, the way his lord father had died, for one.
"I should have made him shit a little gold before expiring."
Lord Tywin might have been niggardly with his approval and affection, but he'd always been open-handed when it came to coin. "The only thing more pitiful than a dwarf without a nose is a dwarf without a nose who has no gold." Tyrion left the fat women to their loaves and kettles and went in search of the cellar where Illyrio had decanted him the night before. It was not hard to find. There was enough wine there to keep him drunk for 100 years. Sweet reds from the Reach and sour reds from Dawn, pale pentushy ambers, the green nectar of Myrrh, 60 casks of Arbor Gold, even wines from the fabled East, from Carth and Yaitai and Ashai by the Shadow. In the end, Tyrion chose a cask of strong wine marked as the private stock of Lord Runsford Redwine, the grandfather of the present Lord of the Arbor. The taste of it was languorous and heady on the tongue, the colour a purple so dark that it looked almost black in the dim-lit cellar. Tyrion filled a cup and a flagon for good measure, and carried them up to the gardens to drink beneath those cherry trees he'd seen. As it happened, he left by the wrong door and never found the pool he had spied from his window. But it made no matter. The gardens behind the manse were just as pleasant and far more extensive. He wandered through them for a time, drinking. The walls would have shamed any proper castle, and the ornamental iron spikes along the top looked strangely naked without heads to adorn them. Tyrion pictured how his sister's head might look up there, with tar in her golden hair and flies buzzing in and out of her mouth. "Yes, and Jamie must have the spike beside her," he decided. "No one must ever come between my brother and my sister." With a rope and a grapnel, he might be able to get over that wall. He had strong arms, and he did not weigh much. He should be able to clamber over if he did not impale himself on the spike. "He will search for a rope on the morrow," he resolved. He saw 3 gates during his wanderings, the main entrance with its gatehouse, a postern by the kennels, and a garden gate hidden behind a tangle of pale ivy. The last was chained, the others guarded. The guards were plump, their faces as smooth as a baby's bottom, and every man of them wore a spiked bronze cap. Tyrion knew eunuchs when he saw them. He knew their sort by reputation. They feared nothing and felt no pain, it was said, and were loyal to their masters unto death. "I could make good use of a few 100 of mine own," he reflected. "A pity I did not think of that before I became a beggar." He walked along a pillared gallery and through a pointed arch and found himself in a tiled courtyard where a woman was washing clothes at a well. She looked to be his own age, with dull red hair and a broad face dotted by freckles. "Would you like some wine?" he asked her. She looked at him uncertainly. "I have no cup for you. We'll have to share." The washerwoman went back to wringing out tunics and hanging them to dry. Tyrion settled on a stone bench with his flagon.
"Tell me, how far should I trust Magister Illyrio?"
The name made her look up.
"Oh, that far."
Chuckling, he crossed his stunted legs and took a drink. "I am loath to play whatever part the cheesemonger has in mind for me, yet how can I refuse him? The gates are guarded. Perhaps you might smuggle me out under your skirts. I'd be so grateful. Why, I'll even wed you. I've two wives already, why not three? Ah, but where would we live?"
He gave her as pleasant a smile as a man with half a nose could manage. "I have a niece in Sunspear, did I tell you? I can make rather a lot of mischief in Dawn with Marcella. I could set my niece and nephew at war. Wouldn't that be droll?"
The washerwoman pinned up one of Illyrio's tunics, large enough to double as a sail. "I should be ashamed to think such evil thoughts. You're quite right. Better if I sought the wall instead. All crimes are wiped clean when a man joins the night's watch, they say. Though I fear they would not let me keep you, sweetling. No women in the watch. No sweet freckly wives to warm your bed at night. Only cold winds, salted cod, and small beer. Do you think I might stand taller in black, my lady?"
He filled his cup again. "What do you say? North or south? Shall I atone for old sins, or make some new ones?"
The washerwoman gave him one last glance, picked up her basket, and walked away. "I cannot seem to hold a wife for very long," Tyrion reflected. Somehow his flagon had gone dry. "Perhaps I should stumble back down to the cellars." The strong wine was making his head spin, though, and the cellar steps were very steep. "Where do oars go?" he asked the wash, flapping on the line. Perhaps he should have asked the washerwoman. "Not to imply that you're a whore, my dear, but perhaps you know where they go." Or better yet, he should have asked his father.
"Wherever whores go,"
Lord Tywin said. "She loved me. She was a crofter's daughter. She loved me and she wed me and put her trust in me." The empty flagon slipped from his hand and rolled across the yard. Tyrion pushed himself off the bench and went to fetch it. As he did, he saw some mushrooms growing up from a cracked paving tile. Pale white they were, with speckles, and red-ribbed undersides dark as blood. The dwarf snapped one off and sniffed it. "Oh, delicious," he thought, "and deadly." There were seven of the mushrooms. Perhaps the seven were trying to tell him something. He picked them all, snatched a glove down from the line, wrapped them carefully, and stuffed them down his pocket. The effort made him dizzy, so afterward he crawled back onto the bench, curled up, and shut his eyes. When he woke again, he was back in his bedchamber, drowning in the goose-down feather bed once more, while a blonde girl shook his shoulder.
"My lord," she said, "your bath awaits. Magister Illyrio expects you at table within the hour."
Tyrion propped himself against the pillows, his head in his hands. "Do I dream, or do you speak the common tongue?"
"Yes, my lord, I was bought to please the king."
She was blue-eyed and fair, young and willowy. "I am sure you did. I need a cup of wine." She poured for him.
"Magister Illyrio said that I am to scrub your back and warm your bed. My name
is of no interest to me. Do you know where whores go?" She flushed.
"Or sell themselves for coin.
Or jewels, or gowns, or castles. But where do they go?" The girl could not grasp a question.
"Is it a riddle, my lord? I'm no good at riddles. Will you tell me the answer?"
"No," he thought. "I despise riddles myself. I will tell you nothing. Do me the same favour." "The only part of you that interests me is the part between your legs," he almost said. The words were on his tongue, but somehow never passed his lips. "She is not she," the dwarf told himself. "Only some little fool who thinks I play at riddles." If truth be told, even her cunt did not interest him much. "I must be sick or dead." "You mentioned a bath. We must not keep the great cheesemonger waiting." As he bathed, the girl washed his feet, scrubbed his back, and brushed his hair. Afterward, she rubbed sweet-smelling ointment into his calves to ease the aches, and dressed him once again in boy's clothing, a musty pair of burgundy breeches, and a blue velvet doublet lined with cloth of gold.
"Will my lord want me after he has eaten?"
she asked, as she was lacing up his boots.
"No, I'm done with women." "Whores."
The girl took that disappointment too well for his liking.
"If my lord would prefer a boy, I can have one waiting in his bed."
"My lord would prefer his wife. My lord would prefer a girl named Taisha."
"Only if he knows where whores go."
The girl's mouth tightened. "She despises me," he realized, "but no more than I despise myself." That he had fucked many a woman who loathed the very sight of him, Tyrion Lannister had no doubt, but the others had at least the grace to feign affection. A little honest loathing might be refreshing, like a tart wine after too much sweet.
"I believe I have changed my mind," he told her. "Wait for me a bed, naked, if you please. I'll be a deal too drunk to fumble at your clothing. Keep your mouth shut and your thighs open, and the two of us should get on splendidly."
He gave her a leer, hoping for a taste of fear, but all she gave him was revulsion. No one fears a dwarf. Even Lord Tywin had not been afraid, though Tyrion had held a crossbow in his hands.
"Do you moan when you are being fucked?" he asked the bed warmer. "If it please my lord."
"It might please my lord to strangle you. That's how I served my last whore."
"Do you think your master would object?"
"Surely not. He has 100 more like you, but no one else like me."
This time, when he grinned, he got the fear he wanted. Illyrio was reclining on a padded couch, gobbling hot peppers and pearl onions from a wooden bowl. His brow was dotted with beads of sweat, his pig eyes shining above his fat cheeks. Jewels danced when he moved his hands, onyx and opal, tiger's eye and tourmaline, ruby, amethyst, sapphire, emerald, jet and jade, a black diamond and a green pearl. "I could live for years on his rings," Tyrion mused, "though I'd need a cleaver to claim them."
"Come sit, my little friend," Illyrio waved him closer.
The dwarf clambered up into a chair. It was much too big for him. A cushioned throne intended to accommodate the magister's massive buttocks, with thick, sturdy legs to bear his weight. Tyrion Lannister had lived all his life in a world that was too big for him, but in the manse of Illyrio Mopatis, the sense of disproportion assumed grotesque dimensions.
"I am a mouse in a mammoth lair," he mused, "though at least the mammoth keeps a good cellar."
The thought made him thirsty. He called for wine.
"Did you enjoy the girl I sent you?" Illyrio asked.
"If I'd wanted a girl, I would have asked for one."
"If she failed to please,
she did all that was required of her."
"I would hope so. She was trained in Lys, where they make an art of love. The king enjoyed her greatly."
"I kill kings, and you heard?"
Tyrion smiled evilly over his wine cup.
"I want no royal leavings." "As you wish. Let us eat."
Illyrio clapped his hands together, and serving men came running. They began with a broth of crab and monkfish, and cold egg lime soup as well. Then came quails in honey, a saddle of lamb, goose livers drowned in wine, buttered parsnips, and suckling pig. The sight of it all made Tyrion feel queasy, but he forced himself to try a spoon of soup for the sake of politeness, and once he had tasted, he was lost. The cooks might be old and fat, but they knew their business. He had never eaten so well, even at court. As he was sucking the meat off the bones of his quail, he asked Illyrio about the morning summons. The fat man shrugged.
There are troubles in the east. Astapor has fallen, and Myrine. Gescari, slave cities that were old when the world was young.
The suckling pig was carved. Illyrio reached for a piece of the crackling, dipped it in a plum sauce, and ate it with his fingers.
Slaver's Bay is a long way from Pentos.
Tyrion speared a goose liver on the point of his knife. No man is as cursed as the Kinslayer, he mused, but I could learn to like this hell.
This is so, Illyrio agreed, but the world is one great web, and a man dare not touch a single strand, lest all the others tremble. More wine?
Illyrio popped a pepper into his mouth.
No, something better.
He clapped his hands together. At the sound, a serving man entered with a covered dish. He placed it in front of Tyrion, and Illyrio leaned across the table to remove the lid.
Mushrooms, the magister announced, as the smell wafted up. Kissed with garlic and bathed in butter. I am told the taste is exquisite. Have one, my friend. Have two.
Tyrion had a fat black mushroom halfway to his mouth, but something in Illyrio's voice made him stop abruptly.
After you, my lord.
He pushed the dish towards his host.
No, no,
Magister Illyrio pushed the mushrooms back. For a heartbeat, it seemed as if a mischievous boy was peering out from inside the cheesemonger's bloated flesh.
After you, I insist. Cook made them specially for you.
Did she indeed? He remembered the cook, the flour on her hands, heavy breast shot through with dark blue veins. That was kind of her, but no. Tyrion eased the mushroom back into the lake of butter from which it had emerged.
You are too suspicious.
Illyrio smiled through his forked yellow beard. Oiled every morning to make them gleam like gold, Tyrion suspected.
Are you craven? I had not heard that of you.
In the Seven Kingdoms, it is considered a grave breach of hospitality to poison your guest at supper.
Here as well, Illyrio Mopatis reached for his wine cup. Yet when a guest plainly wishes to end his own life, why, his host must oblige him, no?
He took a gulp.
Magister Ordello was poisoned by a mushroom not half a year ago. The pain is not so much, I am told. Some cramping in the gut, a sudden ache behind the eyes, and it is gone. Better a mushroom than a sword through your neck, is it not so? Why die with a taste of blood in your mouth when it could be butter and garlic?
The dwarf studied the dish before him. The smell of garlic and butter had his mouth watering. Some part of him wanted those mushrooms, even knowing what they were. He was not brave enough to take cold steel to his own belly, but a bite of mushroom would not be so hard. That frightened him more than he could say.
"You mistake me," he heard himself say. "Is it so, I wonder? If you would sooner drown in wine, say the word, and it should be done, and quickly. Drowning cup by cup wastes time and wine both."
"You mistake me," Tyrion said again, more loudly. The buttered mushrooms glistened in the lamplight, dark and inviting. "I have no wish to die, I promise you. I have..." His voice trailed off into uncertainty. "What do I have? A life to live, work to do, children to raise, lands to rule, a woman to love?"
"You have nothing," finished Magister Illyrio. "But we can change that."
He plucked a mushroom from the butter and chewed it lustily.
"Mmm, delicious."
"The mushrooms are not poisoned?" Tyrion was irritated.
"No, why should I wish you ill?"
Magister Illyrio ate another.
"We must show a little trust, you and I. Come, eat."
He clapped his hands again.
"We have work to do, my little friend. Must keep his strength up."
The serving men brought out a heron stuffed with figs, veal cutlets blanched with almond milk, creamed herring, candied onions, foul-smelling cheeses, plates of snails and sweetbreads, and a black swan in her plumage. Tyrion refused the swan, which reminded him of a supper with his sister. He helped himself to heron and herring, though, and a few of the sweet onions, and the serving man filled his wine cup anew each time he emptied it.
"You drink a deal of wine for such a little man."
"Kinslaying is dry work. It gives a man a thirst." The fat man's eyes glittered like the gemstones on his fingers.
"There are those in Westeros who would say that killing Lord Lannister was merely a good beginning."
"They'd better not say it in my sister's hearing, or they will find themselves short a tongue." The dwarf tore a loaf of bread in half.
"And you had best be careful what you say of my family, Magister. Kinslayer or no, I am a lion still."
That seemed to amuse the Lord of Cheese no end. He slapped a meaty thigh and said,
"You, Westerosi, are all the same. You sew some beast upon a scrap of silk, and suddenly you're all lions, or dragons, or eagles. I can take you to a real lion, my little friend. The prince keeps some pride in his menagerie. Would you like to share a cage with them?"
The lords of the Seven Kingdoms did make rather much of their sigils, Tyrion had to admit.
"Very well," he conceded. "A Lannister is not a lion. Yet I'm still my father's son, and Jaime and Cersei are mine to kill." "How odd that you should mention your fair sister," said Illyrio between snails. "The queen has offered a lordship to the man who brings her your head, no matter how humble his birth." It was no more than Tyrion had expected. "If you mean to take her up on it, make her spread her legs for you as well. The best part of me for the best part of her. That's a fair trade." I would sooner have my own weight in gold." The cheesemonger laughed so hard that Tyrion feared he was about to rupture. "All the gold in Castle Rock. Why not?"
"The gold I grant you," the dwarf said, relieved that he was not about to drown in a gout of half-digested eels and sweetmeats. "But the rock is mine."
"Just so."
The magister covered his mouth and belched a mighty belch.
"Do you think King Stannis will give it to you? I'm told he's a great one for the law. Your brother wears the white cloak, so you are heir by all the laws of Westeros."
"Stannis might well grant me Castle Rock," said Tyrion, "but for the small matter of regicide and kinslaying. For those he would shot me by a head, and I am short enough as I stand. But why would you think I mean to join Lord Stannis?"
"Why else would you go to the wall?"
"Stannis is at the wall." Tyrion rubbed at his nose. "What in seven bloody hells is Stannis doing at the wall?"
"Shivering, I would think. It's warmer down in Dorne. Perhaps he should have sailed that way."
Tyrion was beginning to suspect that a certain freckled washerwoman knew more about the common speech than she pretended. "My niece Missella is in Dorne, as it happens, and I have half a mind to make her a queen." Illyrio smiled as his serving men spooned out bowls of black cherries in sweet cream for them both.
"What has this poor child done to you that you would wish her dead?"
"Even a kinslayer is not required to slay all his kin," said Tyrion, wounded. "Queen her," I said, "not kill her." The cheesemonger spooned up cherries.
"In Valentis they use a coin with a crown on one face and a death's head on the other. Yet it is the same coin. To queen her is to kill her. Dawn might rise for Marcella, but dawn alone is not enough. If you are as clever as our friend insists, you know this."
Tyrion looked at the fat man with new interest. "He is right on both counts. To queen her is to kill her. And I knew that.
Futile gestures are all that remain to me. This one would make my sister weep bitter tears at least."
Magister Illyrio wiped sweet cream from his mouth with the back of a fat hand.
The road to Castle Rock does not go through Dawn, my little friend, nor does it run beneath the wall. Yet there is such a road, I tell you.
I am an attainted traitor, a regicide, and kingslayer. This talk of roads annoyed him. Does he think this is a game?
What one king does, another may undo. In Pentos we have a prince, my friend. He presides at ball and feast, and rides about the city in a palanquin of ivory and gold. Three heralds go before him, with the golden scales of trade, the iron sword of war, and the silver scourge of justice. On the first day of each new year, he must deflower the maid of the fields and the maid of the seas. Illyrio leaned forward, elbows on the table. Yet should a crop fail or a war be lost, we cut his throat to appease the gods and choose a new prince from amongst the 40 families.
Remind me never to become the prince of Pentos.
Are your 7 kingdoms so different? There is no peace in Westeros, no justice, no faith, and soon enough, no food. When men are starving and sick of fear, they look for a savior.
They may look, but if all they find is Stannis, not Stannis, nor Missella. The yellow smile widened.
Another, stronger than Tommen, gentler than Stannis, with a better claim than the girl Missella. A savior come from across the sea to bind up the wounds of bleeding Westeros.
Fine words. Tyrion was unimpressed. Words are wind. Who is this bloody savior?
A dragon.
The cheesemonger saw the look on his face at that and laughed.
A dragon with 3 heads.
Catelyn. Sir Desmond Grell had served House Tully all his life. He'd been a squire when Catelyn was born, a knight when she learned to walk and ride and swim, master at arms by the day she was wed. He had seen Lord Huster's little cat become a young woman, a great lord's lady, mother to a king. And now he has seen me become a traitor as well. Her brother Edmure had named Sir Desmond Castellan of River Run when he rode off to battle, so it fell to him to deal with her crime. To ease his discomfort, he brought her father's steward with him, Dor Uthereyde Swayne. The two men stood and looked at her. Sir Desmond, stout, red-faced, embarrassed, Uthereyde, grave, gaunt, melancholy. Each waited for the other to speak. They have given their lives to my father's service, and I have repaid them with disgrace, Catelyn thought wearily.
Are your sons, Sir Desmond said at last. Maester Wyman told us, the poor lads, terrible, terrible. But we share your grief, my lady, said Uthereyde Swayne. All Riverrun mourns with you, but the news must have driven you mad, Sir Desmond broke in. A madness of grief, a mother's madness. Men will understand. You did not know.
I did, Catelyn said firmly. I understood what I was doing, and I knew it was treasonous. If you fail to punish me, men will believe that we connived together to free Jaime Lannister. It was mine own act, and mine alone, and I alone must answer for it. Put me in the Kingslayer's empty irons, and I will wear them proudly, if that is how it must be.
Fetters! The very word seemed to shock poor Sir Desmond. For the king's mother, my lord's own daughter, oh, impossible.
Mayhaps, said the steward Uthereyde Swayne, my lady would consent to be confined to her chambers until Sir Edmure returns, a time alone to pray for her murdered sons.
Confined, aye, Sir Desmond said, confined to a tower cell that would serve.
If I am to be confined, let it be in my father's chambers, so I might comfort him in his last days.
Sir Desmond considered for a moment. Very well. You shall lack no comfort nor courtesy, but freedom of the castle is denied you. Visit the Sept as you need, but elsewise remain in Lord Huster's chambers until Lord Edmure returns.
As you wish. Her brother was no lord while their father lived, but Catelyn did not correct him. Set a guard on me, if you must, but I give you my pledge that I shall attempt no escape. Sir Desmond nodded, plainly glad to be done with his distasteful task, but sad-eyed Arthur Wayne lingered a moment after the Castellan took his leave.
"It was a grave thing you did, my lady, but for naught. Sir Desmond has sent Sir Robin Ryger after them to bring back the Kingslayer, or, failing that, his head."
Catelyn had expected no less. "May the warrior give strength to your sword arm, Brian," she prayed. She had done all she could. Nothing remained but to hope. Her things were moved into her father's bedchamber, dominated by the great canopy bed she had been born in, its pillars carved in the shapes of leaping trout. Her father himself had been moved half a turn down the stair, his sickbed placed to face the triangular balcony that opened off his solar, from whence he could see the rivers that he had always loved so well. Lord Huster was sleeping when Catelyn entered. She went out to the balcony and stood with one hand on the rough stone balustrade. Beyond the point of the castle, the swift tumblestone joined the placid red fork, and she could see a long way down river. If a striped sail comes from the east, it will be Sir Robin returning. For a moment, the surface of the water was empty. She thanked the gods for that, and went back inside to sit with her father. Catelyn could not say if Lord Huster knew she was there, or if her presence brought him any comfort, but it gave her solace to be with him.
"What would you say if you knew my crime, father?" she wondered. "Would you have done as I did, if it were Lysa and me in the hands of our enemies? Or would you condemn me too, and call it mother's madness?" There was a smell of death about that room, a heavy smell, sweet and foul, clinging. It reminded her of the sons she had lost, her sweet Bran and her little Rickon, slain at the hand of Theon Greyjoy, who had been Ned's ward. She still grieved for Ned. She would always grieve for Ned. But to have her babies taken as well. "It is a monstrous, cruel thing to lose a child," she whispered softly, more to herself than to her father. Lord Huster's eyes opened.
"Tansy,"
he husked, in a voice thick with pain. "He does not know me." Catelyn had grown accustomed to him taking her for her mother or her sister Lysa, but Tansy was a name strange to her.
"It's Catelyn," she said. "It's Cat, father."
"Forgive me. The blood. Oh, please, Tansy."
Could there have been another woman in her father's life, some village maiden he had wronged when he was young, perhaps? Could he have found comfort in some serving wench's arms after mother died? It was a queer thought, unsettling. Suddenly she felt as though she had not known her father at all. "Who is Tansy, my lord? Do you want me to send for her father? Where would I find the woman? Does she still live?" Lord Huster groaned.
"Dead."
His hand groped for hers.
"You will have others, sweet babes, and true-born."
"Others?" Catelyn thought. "Has he forgotten that Ned is gone? Is he still talking to Tansy? Or is it me now, or Lysa, or mother?" When he coughed, the sputum came up bloody. He clutched her fingers.
"Be a good wife, and the gods will bless you. Sons, true-born sons."
A sudden spasm of pain made Lord Huster's hand tighten. His nails dug into her hand, and he gave a muffled scream. Maester Wyman came quickly to mix another dose of milk of the puppy and help his lord swallow it down. Soon enough, Lord Huster Tully had fallen back into a heavy sleep.
"He was asking after a woman," said Cat. "Tansy."
"Tansy?"
The maester looked at her blankly. "You know no one by that name? A serving girl? A woman from some nearby village? Perhaps someone from years past?" Catelyn had been gone from River Run for a very long time.
"No, my lady, I can make inquiries if you like. Authorised Wayne would surely know if any such person ever served at River Run. Tansy, did you say? The small folk often name their daughters after flowers and herbs."
The maester looked thoughtful.
"There was a widow, I recall. She used to come to the castle looking for old shoes in need of new soles. Her name was Tansy, now that I think on it. Or was it Pansy? Some such. But she has not come for many years."
"Her name was Violet," said Catelyn, who remembered the old woman very well.
"Was it?" The maester looked apologetic. "My pardons, Lady Catelyn, but I may not stay. Sir Desmond has decreed that we are to speak to you only so far as our duties require."
"Then you must do as he commands." Catelyn could not blame Sir Desmond. She had given him small reason to trust her, and no doubt he feared that she might use the loyalty that many of the folk of River Run would still feel towards their lord's daughter to work some further mischief. "I am free of the ward, at least," she told herself, "if only for a little while." After the maester had gone, she donned a woolen cloak and stepped out onto the balcony once more. Sunlight shimmered on the rivers, gilding the surface of the waters as they rolled past the castle. Catelyn shaded her eyes against the glare, searching for a distant sail, dreading the sight of one. But there was nothing, and nothing meant that her hopes were still alive. All that day she watched, and well into the night, until her legs ached from the standing. A raven came to the castle in late afternoon, flapping down on great black wings to the rookery. "Dark wings, dark words," she thought, remembering the last bird that had come and the horror it had brought. Maester Vyman returned at evenfall to minister to Lord Tully and bring Catelyn a modest supper of bread, cheese, and boiled beef with horseradish.
I spoke to Authorised Wayne, my lady. He's quite certain that no woman by the name of Tansy has ever been at River Run during his service.
There was a raven today, I saw. Has Jamie been taken again? Or slain? God's forbid.
No, my lady, we've had no word of the Kingslayer.
Is it another battle, then? Is Edmure in difficulty? Or Rob? Please be kind. Put my fears at rest.
My lady, I should not...
Vyman glanced about, as if to make certain no one else was in the room.
Lord Tywin has left the Riverlands. All's quiet on the fords.
Whence came the raven, then?
From the west, he answered, busying himself with Lord Huster's bedclothes and avoiding her eyes.
Was it news of Rob? He hesitated.
Yes, my lady.
Something is wrong. She knew it from his manner. He was hiding something from her. Tell me, is it Rob? Is he hurt?
Not dead. Gods be good, please do not tell me that he is dead. His grace took a wound storming the crag, Maester Vyman said, still evasive, but writes that it is no cause for concern, and that he hopes to return soon.
A wound? What sort of wound? How serious?
No cause for concern, he writes.
All wounds concern me. Is he being cared for?
I'm certain of it. The maester at the crag will tend him, I have no doubt.
Where was he wounded?
My lady, I'm commanded not to speak with you. I am sorry.
Gathering up his potions, Vyman made a hurried exit, and once again Catelyn was left alone with her father. The milk of the poppy had done its work, and Lord Huster was sunk in deep sleep. A thin line of spittle ran down from one corner of his open mouth to dampen his pillow. Catelyn took a square of linen and wiped it away gently. When she touched him, Lord Huster moaned.
"Forgive me,"
he said so softly she could scarcely hear the words.
Tansy, blood, the blood, gods be kind.
His words disturbed her more than she could say, though she could make no sense of them.
Blood, she thought. Must it all come back to blood? Father, who was this woman? And what did you do to her that needs so much forgiveness?
That night, Catelyn slept fitfully, haunted by formless dreams of her children, the lost and the dead. Well before the break of day, she woke with her father's words echoing in her ears, "Sweet babes and trueborn."
Why would he say that, unless... could he have fathered a bastard on this woman Tansy?
She could not believe it. Her brother Edmure, yes, it would not have surprised her to learn that Edmure had a dozen natural children.
But not her father, not Lord Huster Tully, never. Could Tansy be some pet name he called Lysa, the way he called me Cat?
Lord Huster had mistaken her for her sister before. "You'll have others," he said, "sweet babes and trueborn." Lysa had miscarried 5 times, twice in the Aerie, thrice at King's Landing, but never at River Run, where Lord Huster would have been at hand to comfort her.
Never, unless she was with child that first time.
She and her sister had been married on the same day, and left in their father's care when their new husbands had ridden off to rejoin Robert's rebellion. Afterward, when their moonblood did not come at the accustomed time, Lysa had gushed happily of the son she was certain they carried. "Your son will be heir to Winterfell and mine to the Eyrie. Oh, they'll be the best of friends like your Ned and Lord Robert. There'll be more brothers and cousins, truly, I just know it." She was so happy. But Lysa's blood had come not long after, and all the joy had gone out of her. Catelyn had always thought that Lysa had simply been a little late. But if she had been with child. She remembered the first time she gave her sister Rob to hold, small, red-faced and squalling, but strong even then, full of life. No sooner had Catelyn placed the babe in her sister's arms than Lysa's face dissolved into tears. Hurriedly, she had thrust the baby back at Catelyn and fled.
If she had lost a child before, that might explain father's words, and much else besides.
Lysa's match with Lord Arryn had been hastily arranged, and John was an old man even then, older than their father. An old man without an heir. His first 2 wives had left him childless. His brother's son had been murdered with Brandon Stark in King's Landing. His gallant cousin had died in the Battle of the Bells. He needed a young wife if House Arryn was to continue. A young wife known to be fertile. Catelyn rose, threw on a robe, and descended the steps to the darkened solar to stand over her father. A sense of helpless dread filled her. "Father," she said. "Father, I know what you did." She was no longer an innocent bride with a head full of dreams. She was a widow, a traitor, a grieving mother, and wise, wise in the ways of the world. "You made him take her," she whispered. "Lysa was the price John Arryn had to pay for the swords and spears of House Tully." Small wonder her sister's marriage had been so loveless. The Arryns were proud and prickly of their honour. Lord John might wed Lysa to bind the Tullys to the cause of the rebellion and in the hopes of a son, but it would have been hard for him to love a woman who came to his bed soiled and unwilling. He would have been kind, no doubt, dutiful, yes, but Lysa needed warmth. The next day, as she broke her fast, Catelyn asked for quill and paper and began a letter to her sister in the Vale of Arryn. She told Lysa of Bran and Rickon, struggling with the words, but mostly she wrote of their father. "His thoughts are all of the wrong he did you, now that his time grows short. Maester Vyman says He dare not make the milk of the puppy any stronger. It is time for Father to lay down his sword and shield. It is time for him to rest.